I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is engineer and former NASA astronaut Mike Massimino. He's joined in conversation by industrial special effects designer, actor, educator, and television host Adam Savage. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Mike Massimino and Adam Savage.
A 6'3" blue-collar kid from Long Island with poor eyesight and a fear of heights is not what you'd call a surefire bet for the space program. But Mike Massimino is no ordinary guy. He was an astronaut with NASA and is a veteran of two space flights, STS-109 aboard Space Shuttle Columbia in March 2002 and STS-125 aboard Space Shuttle Atlantis in May 2009, for the amazing historic final repair of the Hubble Space Telescope. Mike has many accomplishments, including a team record for the number of hours spacewalking in a single space shuttle mission, and the first person to tweet from space, with over 1.3 million Twitter followers and counting. He also has a recurring role as himself on The Big Bang Theory. These days, Mike is back at his alma mater, Columbia University, where he's a professor of engineering. And he's also the senior advisor for space programs at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York. He's here this afternoon to tell us about his new memoir, Spaceman, an astronaut's unlikely journey to unlock the secrets of the universe, and to share some of his interesting moments on this planet and far above it, and what having the right stuff really means at NASA, in space, and in life. Appearing in conversation with Mike this afternoon is the wonderfully multi-talented Adam Savage, who's best known as the former co-host of MythBusters and Unchained Reaction, as well as an industrial designer, artist, and educator. Let's give them both a very warm welcome to the JCCSF.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. We've got a freaking astronaut on stage.
Thank you very much for coming. It's very nice to see everybody. Well, we can't see him very well, but no. It's nice to know everybody's out there.
They're a very attractive crowd.
Yeah.
if you ever take an improv class to learn improv comedy. One of the key concepts of an improv class is status. I'm leading
really?
Somewhere, yeah.
I've learned so much from Adam just in a couple minutes backstage. Now I'm continuing to learn. This is great. Okay.
Everyone carries with them a natural status.
Uh-huh.
And, for instance, policemen and policewomen are trained to have the highest status in an interaction, and it's how they maintain control over a situation.
Okay.
But not everyone... And then I met... So then I work with a lot of cops, and I can see them... having that high status. And then I met a surgeon, and I saw a higher status than that.
Really?
And then I had dinner with an astronaut, Ed Liu, who was the first astronaut that I met. And I saw your whole astronaut corps is a level of status that is above any
above
surgeon
the cops?
Or cop I've ever met.
What happens
met.
When we get pulled over? I don't know.
I hope you have the NASA cap and they just let you go.
You got to try that next time. Yeah.
So it took you four tries to become an astronaut.
Yes.
Over how many years?
It did. That started around 88 or so and got picked in 96. So NASA was picking astronauts about every 2 years then. So I started my first application went in about 1988.
So over 8 years, did any of your friends...
applying before then is preparation and thinking about it and so on. But yeah. I'm sorry, did any of my friends...
Did any of your friends say after 8 years, Mike, maybe this isn't your thing?
I guess everyone was kind of wondering. I think in general it's such a almost impossible thing to get to. And I remember, Adam, when I was in grad school, when I started applying and I was rejected once, and I was getting closer. I started working for NASA over the summers when I could and meet people and so on. And the more I learned about NASA, the more I learned about the astronaut job in particular, the more I realized this is the greatest job in the world, right? There's no doubt. I had to be honest with you. It was sort of depressing because I also realized there's no way you're ever going to get this job was my thinking. And I remember distinctly thinking about that in my dorm room as a grad student there and kind of being almost a little bit sad about it, that I know this is the thing I want to do. If there was one thing in my life I could do for a job, for a career, that absolutely that's what I wanted to do, but I knew it was so difficult to get it. So I think all along anyone that knew me realized that it was a long shot for anybody, but particularly for me. But they also knew it was important, and I knew it was important to keep trying no matter what.
Were they rejecting you for the same reason each time, or were the reasons new?
They had a little bit of interest, and they looked in. I got some questions about it. It started then with my eyesight, right? And I described this in a book that I can't see very well, you know, I'm nearsighted. And back then, now it's a lot different. Now they accept LASIK and other things don't go on off and do this without reading the regulations for sure for astronaut hopefuls. But now they've relaxed it a bit. But back then, this is, you know, over 20 years ago, and they still were. The pilots had to see 20/20 uncorrected vision, and then the mission specialists, like I was, still had a requirement. It wasn't as stringent as about 2150 or 2200. That also changed from time to time. But the first time I got rejected was pretty much because they knew my nearsightedness was too much. They couldn't handle that, and so I got rejected that first time that way. But I got to the level they were checking my references. So they have these different. You have qualified, then highly qualified, then most qualified, and then you get picked, right? So you have these different levels.
Right.
So I had gotten through that first level. So I was pretty excited, even though I got dinged on my eyesight.
Right.
So then I was able to do something I described in the book to help with my vision, and I was in there again. I could be eligible again. And I didn't get anybody even checking my references. And I found out that I went down. I don't know why, but I went down. They didn't like what they saw the first time maybe, or they just over, you know, it's yeah. hard looking at all these applications. So I went down, and the third time I got an interview and was medically disqualified. And then I tried again the fourth time, and I made it through the medical successfully that time and got picked. I don't know if it's one thing that you see. You know, I can't really say that there was something that changed. I think I just got older. It was one thing, and I showed maybe a little more perseverance. But I think really what it comes down to is there's some good fortune involved with this. And I remember our first day at work, when we showed up, all of us together, you know, the next group of astronauts, it was group 16, and all of us are there. And they said, come to the Johnson Space Center at this time, and we all showed up. We had to dress like grown-ups, you know, with a tie and a jacket and everything, because we were going to take a photo and meet the press one day, and that was it. We couldn't talk to the press for a year because we were supposed to concentrate. But I remember being there, and Bob Cabana, who is the head of the astronaut office, Marine colonel, and had flown in space several times, commander, and so on, now runs the Kennedy Space Center. But I remember he said to us, you've been given the greatest opportunity in the world. And there's a lot of people, thousands of people, that would want to be here today in your place. And you owe it to them to do the best job you can. And there's really no difference between you and them, except that you're more fortunate. And he wasn't trying to make us feel bad,
right.
But he was trying to tell us that, hey, we're all very fortunate. We all won the lottery by getting picked. And so when you get to something like this, I think there is an element of good fortune that's involved. So I'll call on that for why I did finally get picked.
And NASA's changed its requirements or what it looks for in an astronaut over the course of its missions. I mean, in the beginning, from what I understand, the original Mercury 7, personality-wise, might not have been the best school of...
I don't know, well, but I think those guys, I've gotten, John Glenn wrote a blurb for the book, and he was one of my heroes, and I've gotten to meet a couple of those guys. They were all military test pilots,
right.
You know, from a different era, you know, it was all dudes, all military test pilots, and they came and became astronauts. That was a completely different era. And you're right in that as time went on, especially with the shuttle program, it wasn't just one or two guys going to space, it was a mix of people, and you needed more skills than military test pilots, which we still have. But when the shuttle program came in, it opened it up to to women. The first women were picked, first female astronauts, and people of color and different sizes as well. It, taller people and smaller people. It opened it up to a lot of people, the eligibility requirements. So, and then as time went on, I think what maybe you get is the ability to get along. And with dealing with a crew of seven, even though you may only be in space, like with the shuttle for 2 weeks, you're training with each other for years.
You're gaming every single possible scenario you could encounter.
That's right. You're gaming everything. Yeah, and it leads to, you know, sometimes a conflict might arise or a disagreement. So it's kind of like being part of a family,
right.
Hopefully a functional one. You know, everyone loves each other, but you disagree every once in a while. But it's really important to get along. And then it became a little bit, you know, the psychological part of it seemed to change a little bit in the selections that I was involved with, because they were looking for people who potentially would be long-duration crew members on space station, not just shuttle. And so the ability to get along with people over a long period of time in space was important. So the ability to get along and be a good team player and just be someone that people can count on and look at your success as not an individual success, but as a team success, that's what's important. Also, your failures, it's not you're going to succeed or you're going to fail as a team, and that's right. That's what you're going to strive for success-wise. And I think as far as like the military-civilian thing there, what I found is I think what they look for is where, military guy, men and women that can play with civilians, you know, egghead civilians, you know, mad scientists.
Yeah.
Charlie Holboss, Scorchus, Marine pilot. It was a few of, like, there was Steve McClain, Don Pettit. You know Don Pettit? You know,
I don't know. We corresponded.
Someone else was in there with us, and he called. He used to come in and goes, you guys, this is the mad scientist, nutty professor room, is what he called us. And so, but Scorch was a Marine test pilot who, can get along with anybody, and I think they look for civilians that could mix with anybody as well. So getting along, yes, was very important.
When I mentioned I was interviewing you to my son, 17 years old, and mm-hmm. I mentioned that you were one of the larger astronauts, he repeated the oft-quoted myth, oh, you can't be an astronaut if you're over 6 feet tall, right?
No, I'm way over 6 feet.
And your size, you're 6'3".
Yeah, I'm not even the
biggest
one.
Was your size in danger of disqualifying you?
No, that was one thing that was okay, luckily, was my size. 6'4" was the limit for the shuttle. For the Soyuz now, it's a sitting height requirement, but supposedly I would fit in there as well. But no, I think one of the great things about the shuttle was that it expanded the envelope. I think it went from 4'11" up to 6'4". So it was not I don't know what I would have done about that. I don't know if trouble with my eyesight. Yeah. I don't know what I would have done. I got to lose a couple inches.
Inches.
But they probably frown upon that. You know, I would have done it, but they'd be like, oh, no, yeah, you know. What happened to the rest of your shin,
right.
You know? Like, well, you know, I wanted it. Like, well, you know, there's other requirements besides just height. Now you only have half, you know, so.
Well, I've heard that you have the largest hands. The largest hands that have gone to space.
Did I tell you that?
Told me that over a dozen sizes of hands, but yours, the
really?
Molds of your hands are large in space.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah, but I got to update my bio. People tell me this stuff. I never knew this stuff. Like, I heard we made such a big deal on our, you learn about this. You don't believe it. I want to hang around with Adam for as long as I possibly can because I have learned so much. Now I'm learning about myself. I didn't realize that. Someone came up to me a couple years ago and said, you were the last person to work inside of the Hubble Space Telescope. And I go, I was? We made a big deal, but the press asked us who's going to be the last one to touch the Hubble. And that was John Grunsfeld on our flight on the last EVA. But they didn't open up the telescope that day. On the previous EVA, I was inside working. And so they said, you're the last person to work inside a Hubble. This is like 4 years after the flight. I was like, yeah, no one ever told me that before. I never thought of that. And then someone told me that I was a member of the STS-109. We were the largest flight by height. The average height of all of us. And we had Nancy Curry, who was a smaller astronaut, was about 5 foot tall, thrown in there. But even with Nancy, we were a bunch of big goons. We're like Nancy and the goons. And we were they're learning. I never knew this. And now what is it? I got the largest hands of any astronaut?
Yep. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. I should have thumb wrestled with them more often. I should have. I had no idea. Thank you for letting me know. That was Hadfield said that.
Hadfield.
Oh, it's got to be correct then. Hadfield.
He apparently has dead medium hands.
Does he?
He's right.
He's
in
the average guy. He's the average astronaut. Yeah. Interesting. Well, he's above average in everything.
Yes.
Hands may be average, but above average in everything else.
I'm curious about these two tracks where you're in your dorm room and you're thinking, this is the only thing I want to do. This is the main thing I want to try is to get into the astronaut corps. At the same time as you're thinking, it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
That's an impressive pair of things to hold in your mind at the same time. To be okay with, I don't think this is ever going to happen, but I'm going to keep on grinding and pushing at it.
It's interesting, Anna, because I think what was hard and what I encourage people to do is to be honest with yourself about what it is that you like. And it may be tough to accept because for whatever reason it might be scary or it might be really hard to accomplish or you know it's never been done before or how can I do that? But that still doesn't... That doesn't change the truth. And when I really thought about it, the truth was I wanted to be an astronaut. I didn't even want to just fly in space. That was part of it. What I wanted to do is I wanted to be part of that team. I wanted to be a NASA astronaut. I wanted to go to the Johnson Space Center for work every day, and I wanted to do that and help in the Mission Control Center and help design spacesuits and learn about what it was like to be part of that community. That's what I wanted to be. And I knew that was very, very unlikely for anyone, especially for me.
Statistically, it's
impossible, right?
Right?
You know, you had thousands of applicants, and many of them, most of them, very well qualified, and that's where I think the good fortune comes in. But I think what was important there is really being honest with yourself, which I found to be tough to do. And I realized, I could say stupid things like, I really don't want it that bad, or you have to travel a lot, you know, like above the plus, not a good thing, you know, or, you know, it's dangerous and so on. I could make up things to try to pretend that it wasn't what it was. But the truth in my heart, I knew that that's exactly what I wanted to do. And I couldn't lie to myself about that. That was a fact. And I felt like I wasn't being true to myself if I lied to myself and pretended that that wasn't the case and made up excuses of why I really didn't want to do this just because it wasn't, you know, near impossible. So once I realized that, then it was, well, you know, these are unfortunate statistics that I'm working against here. But I always knew that there's always a chance as long as I tried, right?
Right.
And the probability might be 0.00000000. And you go, zero's gone for a long while. But at the end of all those zeros, there's a one, right?
Yeah.
And that's good enough, okay? And then the only way that would become a zero at the end is if I gave up, which a lot of people did, and hopefully for the right reasons. But you know, I met when I was at Georgia Tech, after I interviewed my third interview, I met another young professor there who had interviewed. I just showed up at Georgia Tech after this interview process was over, about 6 months after that, and one of the professors said, hey, you know, there's a guy in electrical engineering that's just interviewed as well. And so we had this thing in common. Only 120 people interviewed. He didn't get picked either. So I went over and visited with him. Great guy, invited me over to the house. And this guy was really impressive. You know, this guy was good. I'm like, how the heck did they not pick this guy? You know, I can't chop liver next to this guy, right?
If they didn't choose him.
How am I ever going to get in? So I asked him the question, are you going to apply again? And he says, no, I don't think so. And I said, why not? And he said, they told me no once. You're going to tell me no again, probably. And Adam, I hate to say this, I didn't say a word. I didn't tell him, you know, I was like, here's my opportunity to encourage someone. And I didn't say a word. I was just like, I didn't say, you're right, you'll never get picked. I just said, interesting, how's the burgers doing? And I was so relieved.
You
I
just
didn't
saw
want to say,
one
I'm
less
ashamed.
Zero in the number.
I'm right. I'm ashamed. I'm very ashamed. But I gave him no encouragement whatsoever. But, you know, that's the way you eliminate yourself from things. If you want to make sure you're not going to do it, don't try.
So that self-honesty you just exhibited right there. I mean, being honest about your abilities is really important in the training to be an astronaut because NASA is examining all of your failures rigorously.
Yeah. No, this is really important right there because if you screw something up, right, and it's completely your fault, the thing you need to do in the culture there would encourage you to do was to admit it, right? So, and that was really important for a number of reasons. You got to share your mistakes.
Okay.
You're listening to engineer and former NASA astronaut Mike Massimino, whose new book is Spaceman. He's joined in conversation by Adam Savage on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Sometimes you might make a mistake that could endanger someone else. Like if you did something to an airplane that was really dumb and you didn't tell anybody about it, and then that airplane, you know, if you, not that this ever happened to me, but, you know, something happened to you, if you're, you know, if an airplane, if something happened to an airplane, if you, well, something that I did do in the airplane is that, you know, very concerned about foreign object debris inside of the aircraft. So I was playing with my pen in the jet one day flying, and all of a sudden, you know, the clip of the pen goes flying and it goes next to the seat, and I couldn't find it, right? So, but that could be a real hazard for someone flying that aircraft. And so as soon as we landed, I called over the crew chief and I says, you're going to have to take the seat out or we need to find it. He kind of held me up by my legs as I'm in the jet trying to find, you know, he's up on the ladder holding me. I don't know if I'm giving you a great picture here, but I went digging and I found that thing, you know, I felt foolish about it, but I needed to fess that up. So that's one part of it. The other part is that, you know, mistakes are meant to be repeated. So when you're having it, if you have an issue, if you find something wrong, and because whether it's your fault or not, it's important to share that so that the next astronaut doesn't run into that problem, whatever it might be. And it might be embarrassing, but you need to let them know. For me, on my third spacewalk in my career, I was outside, and the whole spacewalk, it was. I was in the telescope a lot. I don't know the attitude of the shuttle. We have a gold visor that we can put down in the sun, right? You know, and we usually do a check of that every orbit, you know, up and down, you know, because you don't want to have your visor down and in the sunlight and so on. But I mean, in the darkness. But what happened is just so I'm toward the end of that spacewalk and I was getting tired. All of a sudden, the sun's getting me in the eyes for the first time, right? So I put that gold visor down. I wasn't used to this routine, I guess, and I was tired and wasn't thinking. And then we go into a night pass, right? And it gets really dark, and I forget I have my visor down, and I can't see a thing, right? I can't see a thing, and I'm wondering what's going on. Who turned off the lights? The only thing that made sense to me, Adam, is that I was dying. I thought I was actually going to expire, and I was like, wow, you know, this is, and it was kind of calming. It really wasn't that bad. I was wondering what it would feel like, you know. I was like, wow, okay, I'm going to maybe die out here, but I got to, and I couldn't see anything. I get inside the airlock, and I know, whoa, I had my visor down. Right, so I made sure that I told, you know, at least my friends in the shuttle that, hey, just be careful. Yeah. If you're out there and it's really dark, check your visor, okay? Because it could be potentially dangerous. I mean, I was messing with safety tethers at the end of it, unhooking my safety tether and putting another one in, and I couldn't really see so well, and now I know why after I got inside. So I was embarrassed by it, you know, you idiot, you know, but now even all of you. This is a very helpful tip for all of you. If you're spacewalking and it gets dark outside, make sure it's your vibe. But I mean, it's a little tip like that. But there are even more so that are more important wherever it might be that you want to be honest. Even though it may make you look foolish, it's really important to tell that, to fess up if you've made a mistake. And there's no repercussion for doing that as long as you're honest. When you start hiding stuff, that's when you get in trouble.
Or when you have people who don't like to admit that they've made a mistake.
That's the problem. Yeah, people don't want to, like, I know I was right. You know, no, that's not a good idea. Yeah, no, that doesn't work either. And, so that actually is, I think, a really good culture to come from, because that sort of not admitting you made a mistake, that type of arrogance. And the reason you can't do it is because that's what leads to accidents.
Right.
And that's why I think our military culture that is in part of the astronaut office, you know, where it came out of these test pilots, still with a lot of military people here, they've seen where things like that, like people not sharing their lessons learned, people hiding mistakes that they made, or just pure arrogance can get people killed.
Yeah. Right?
And that's really not a good thing, of course. But it's not just being a good citizen. It's because there's a danger involved with operating that way.
But then in a culture that is always at the absolute outside edge of innovation, like NASA, that becomes a critical thing for the teamwork. I mean, and we exist in this culture where in a lot of corporations, a lot of corporate cultures or even academia, people hold on to their failures and don't let them be known. they feel like they need to, and that doesn't engender the best kind of teamwork.
No, it doesn't. And it's interesting when I speak at companies, this is what they're looking for. They want people to be able to admit that they made failures without the fear of being made to feel like an idiot or repercussions. And you need to be able to feel like you can fess up. You need to be able to do that. And I think it's very important. I think it's what I find interesting is one of the things I learned as an astronaut with some of this military culture is they're because the stakes are so high in what they're doing, you know, they can't afford for this, you know, for not playing well together, you know, for not being a good citizen, let's say, or a good friend or a good teammate, because you cannot be successful without it in space, or I think in lots of other things, even in business. You know, you might not get killed, but still, you're not going to be successful. And one very important element of that teamwork is sharing your failures, looking for help when you need it. And that's been really important to me. And, you know, the theme in the book, more or less, is when I had failure, when I wasn't doing as well as I would have hoped, I got help. And you need to be willing to give help when you see your buddy needs it, but sometimes it's almost more important to reach out and get that help. And that, I think, is just as important. You've got to be self-aware enough to say, hey, I'm having trouble here, and I'm going to go down and smoke unless I get some help.
That honesty with which you talk about that in the book is one of my favorite aspects of it. It's really important for people to understand. And when you go and do the spacewalks like you did, you pre-do those walks in simulation in the NASA pool like hundreds of times, right? Like you tried to work through every possible scenario.
Right. And those are dress rehearsals in the pool. Before we go in the pool, we're practicing, you know, at a tabletop everything we're going to do with all the tools. And we go over the procedures, and we go to virtual reality. We go have an air-bearing floor with stuff kind of... You would love this stuff over there. You've been down there to JSC.
I have, just briefly, but I want to go
for a
there's
a lot of toys to play with over there. You want to go down there. Let me know when you're going down there. They may let me play again if you're there.
Oh, good.
But you play around on an air-bearing floor in the actual simulator itself, where there's, you know, computer graphics as well. But you do all that, and then in really kind of like the final step is to go into the pool and practice in the pool.
And even with all of that, were there situations that came up that you didn't expect on the walks?
Yeah, some of them. One thing you don't expect is how beautiful the view is around you. And we can talk about that as well if you like, but the extraordinary view of our planet is really indescribable.
Well, there's a lot of talk about it online. It's gained the name the overview effect.
Yeah.
That is a life-altering thing. Is it a life-altering thing to see?
For me, it was, because I knew it was going to be beautiful. You know, I knew I've seen pictures, and I was expecting it to be beautiful. You know, and when I saw it, when I first got to orbit and I unstrapped and went up to the window to take a look, we were over the Indian Ocean, and I was looking through the overhead windows of the orbit. It was just a beautiful day, and it was just wonderful. What I found, though, even more compelling was the spacewalks and being out there in a spacewalk. The Hubble altitude is a bit higher than the station. It's 100 miles higher, so you can see more of the curve of the planet. You see it more as a globe. And I describe it as best I can in the book, but the reason I describe it is because the way I was feeling is what I share, because there are no words to this to really give it justice. You know, the word beautiful or awesome doesn't do it. So I talk about what I was thinking, what my emotions were, and there's a few different things that happen, but what it leads to is this moment where, as I'm looking at the planet, and I just kind of forgot where I was and just looked at it and soaked it in, was that if we were in heaven, looking down on the planet, this is what we would see.
Wow.
You know, and not from a religious standpoint, right? Just kind of like, you know, if we were up away in paradise looking down, and I was like, no, that ain't it. It just thought through, and that this is not it. And not anything I was thinking, it was just like almost these random thoughts kind of going through my head, these emotions. I was just like, no, that's not it. It's not the view from heaven. This is what heaven must look like. And I felt at that moment that I was looking into paradise. And I really think we live in a paradise. And whatever we would imagine, or whatever heaven is, whatever it's described, or whatever people think that might be, I can't imagine it being more beautiful than our planet. So I think we're very, very lucky to live here. And that was unexpected. I didn't know exactly what that was going to happen. And then from a more practical standpoint, as far as things like, you know, you work on a lot of stuff, right? We could have used you. Because things break all the time, right? In your shop, probably. You're trying to build something that doesn't work. And
I've spent my whole life wanting to be in the room during Apollo 13 when they need to build the oxygen scrubber.
You could have done that, yeah.
My whole life has been spent wanting to be in that space.
You would have been perfect for it. Yeah.
I would have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's kind of what it is, you know, not necessarily building that, but coming up with things that you have to improvise on the spot, which I think is a good reason to have humans there because we can improvise and a good reason to have a lot of support helping you. And on our flight, the way I looked at the pool, we were talking a minute ago about the pool training. The way I see that training and all the training we're doing is we're trying to, at first you try to imagine what can go wrong and try to be prepared for it because there's no hardware store around the corner when you're up there, right? And there's usually, we can come back tomorrow. No, you're here now. It's got to be solved now. So you want to think of everything that can go wrong and be prepared to handle it in short order. And you can imagine these things. You try to imagine what can go wrong. You talk about it, brainstorm about it, and then you practice in the pool and in these other places. But primarily in the pool, you will discover lots of things that are problems. And I felt like there's a list of things somewhere. I don't know who has this list, but it exists somewhere in the imaginary world. There's this list of things that can go wrong on a spacewalk, right? And you're trying to think of as many of those things you can, check them off. So you're prepared, and then you discover them in the pool, and you can check those off. But there's still part of that list that you never find out, and you find that out in orbit. So what we're trying to practice, I think, more than anything, is the ability to solve problems together. And things that we didn't anticipate, how do we go through that, through the checklist as best we can and the different options? And because you can't anticipate everything, so you want to be able to work really well at problem solving. But we did have a problem on orbit that where there was, a screw that I thought was going to be easy to remove. There was a handrail that had to come off, and we did have a problem with a strip screw that we had to improvise on. So that's in the book. I don't know if I want to leave it for the readers in the book. But it was a bit dramatic at the time, but I stripped the screw in space, which was unexpected.
And we had
to improvise. Very bad, yeah. Because I was like, oops. And that's where teamwork is really important because I couldn't blame it on anybody else. So, I was like, well, it's my fault, but my team stuck with me and we were able to get it sorted out. But there are things, every spacewalk, every one of them, there were things that I've been on, or when my buddies were outside and I was on the inside, there has been something unexpected happen that we did not prepare for that we had to improvise over. It's going to happen at least once. And you hope that you're going to be able to fix it on the spot. And you say, geez, why didn't we think of that beforehand?
And along those lines, you set out to write a book. You were letting me know backstage that the book you ended up with was a little different than the book you thought you were going to end up
with. Yeah. I thought it was going to be Mike's Shenanigans in Space with His Friends.
Which is,
that's what I thought
by
it was
the way, the
be.
Greatest title for a book ever.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was going to be. Mike's Shenanigans in Space. Or Shenanigans in Space.
I thought shenanigans were very important in the title.
Totally.
To represent my experiences as an astronaut. And all these, these funny stories that I had, things just that funny stuff that, that happened that were ridiculously, I thought very, very funny and ridiculous that happened. And that I've enjoyed telling people, different audiences I've spoken to. I was like, now I get a chance to write these down. Well, it didn't really work out that way. You know, a lot of the stories didn't fit or didn't flow and were a little bit. So hopefully there's a second book. I think I'm going to call it A Funny Thing Happened to Me on the Way to the Rocket Ship. That would be the second where I can tell all the funny stories. So a couple sort of funny stories made it in there. But it became, as I was writing it, and I had a co-writer, Tana Colby, who helped me with this, and a great editor, Kevin Doughton, at Crown Publishing to help as well. And as we were forming it and writing it, it tended to be more about a little bit of fun stuff. And I think there is some fun stuff in there, certainly. But it was also ended up being more, as I was getting the story out and telling it and writing it down, it was about following in a dream and not giving up. And that seemed to resonate. It was what I wanted to share. To me, that was
probably... That came
in the process of writing it. Yeah, all these stories about that. I talked to my co-writer about it. And he's like, wow, that's pretty amazing, and that you didn't give up there. You didn't give up here or there. You got help like you did, and I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. And I go, yeah, I guess, And I also, what I found speaking to, particularly to younger audiences, elementary school, high school, college students that are, you know, trying to follow this path, or young people, or people any age really, but trying to find their path. This idea of coming to grips with what you really love, understanding that it's unlikely, and then pursuing it, and then being, and then failure. And, you know, I failed a lot. I got knocked down a lot. I was disappointed a lot. But to me, that was really personal, and it was great to get it out and make it part of the story. And then I think it picked up and became one of the themes of the book. And one of the things that I noticed throughout meeting someone like you, Adam, or whether it's someone in sports or a rock and roll star, whatever it might be, and I'm sure you've had the same experience. One of the good things about having a job like this is you get to meet cool people every once in a while. And what I found with people I've met is that they're not the successful people are not those that never failed. They're those who never let failure stop them. And so the resiliency of being able to get back up again is very important. And so that was very special to me and became sort of a theme in the book. Another theme that I was a little surprised at that came out was this idea of doing something for public service. And I didn't think too much about it, but I always did have this interest in trying to do something what I thought was for the public good. You know, whatever ability I had or education I was able to get, I wanted to use it to help out in any way I could. And I think I got that from my dad. My dad worked for the New York City Fire Department, was an inspector, and took his job very seriously. I mean, he had fun at the fire department, but you know, they saw it as an important job, and they were helping people. And for whatever reason, I think it was where I grew up, there was a lot of policemen and firemen and people like that, and I think that kind of rubbed off on me. And in my pursuit of being an astronaut, that's something that I wanted as well. So that was another thing. And then I think the third theme that you find in the book that I was hoping was going to be in there was just how cool it is to fly in space. So I think that hopefully that made it in there. But those other ones I wasn't. I thought it was going to be a book about shenanigans, and there's some shenanigans.
Can you share with us a couple of shenanigans?
That are not in the book?
That are not in the book?
The ones that are not in the book?
I know that there are some things that happen that are not glamorous, right?
Yeah.
You're up in space. And
right. Shenanigans. Shenanigans that I can share. shenanigans that I can share. Well, I'll just kind of mention one. This is a very long story. So, but I nearly got into a fight in front of the Pope, in front of Pope John Paul II.
Oh.
Yeah, I almost got into a fight in front of John Paul II, and it was a very long story. So, but that was one of them. And what it was is I was trying to give the Pope a presentation item, and there's a long line, and they were trying to rush me along, and I was fighting with his handler, more or less, and so this happened. So my friends thought this was hilarious because I was trying to get into heaven,
right?
So I was trying to get in because I'm going to meet John Paul II. This is going to be it's going to make up for a lot of indiscretions, right?
Right.
I want to get on a good list,
St.
Peter. This is what they teach us in Catholic schools, it's like in church. St. Peter's going to be there with the clipboard. He's going, man, no. And he'll go, oh, you met the Pope. Okay, good. That's good. So I'm trying to get into heaven. So I'm trying to make a good impression, and some guy's pulling on the thing I'm trying to give to the Pope, and I'm kind of, struggling with him. And, it's like, I'm going to get into a fight in front of the Pope. It's not going to be good. So we thought this was really funny until, I'll tell you the next part of the story, but not all of it. I'll try it in with this next part. Until a few years later when John Paul II died and he was replaced by the new pope, and I was watching television of scenes of the new pope. He was very close to the pope, and my buddies and I came to the conclusion that the guy I was fighting with was the new pope, was Pope Benedict. So I'm only giving you a little sneak. Did you like that story? That's only a flavor of it. So that goes in a funny thing happened to me on the spaceship.
Yeah.
That's one of them. That's one of the, and there's more, and the story continues. That's only a little snippet of it, but it was quite an experience meeting the Pope. So that was like one story that I thought would be in the book, but didn't make it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features engineer and former NASA astronaut Mike Massimino, whose new book is Spaceman. He's joined in conversation by Adam Savage. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There's a lot of development that's been going on in the space program over the last few years. How do you feel about the growing public-private partnership between private space and public space?
I think it's great. I think it's great for a lot of reasons. I think it's needed because our government cannot afford to do things like we used to. Or when I was a little boy watching Apollo, you can remember that as well, yeah?
I'm a little younger.
Okay, so. But that was a different era. You know, we can't do something like that anymore, I don't think. We just can't afford to do it. So if we are going to go to Mars or beyond low Earth orbit, and NASA has plans to do that, building a big rocket ship and a spaceship called Orion, I think they'll do that. But if we're really going to go to Mars, I don't see how we can afford to do it, unless we have a huge bunch of money go to NASA, which would be very nice, but I don't know if that's going to happen either because we've got other things that are important to pay for. So I think the only hope we have is for these private companies to work with NASA. NASA has a lot of know-how. There's a lot of smart people that have been studying going to Mars for a very long time. And they have that knowledge. They just don't have the budget really to follow through and get people there. But if we can get a partnership between some of these private companies and NASA to go there, I think that'll work. And other countries, too. I think the International Space Station has not included the entire world, but it's included the United States and Russia and the countries of Europe and the European Space Agency, Canada and Japan, and occasionally other guests. I think that's the way to do this, because we can. It's also great for international cooperation because we can agree on a technical scientific project to do together, even if we can't agree on other stuff. You know, we get along very well with the cosmonauts and astronauts from other countries because
there's less politics when science is involved.
Or if your butt is involved, if you're worried about because something happening to you, all of a sudden, you know, my best friend is going to keep me safe. I don't care where he's from. You know, we're gonna become friends. And when science is involved and you have a shared goal, then everything else, the politics go away. So I think it's great for international cooperation. And I think these private companies can help lead the way because they're used to getting stuff done. You know, we talked about the Big Bang Theory set where they built a Soyuz. It was amazing how quickly they built a, it was out of plywood, but still, they put it together. It looked like a real Soyuz.
I would love to have one of those.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was really quick, but, you know, this is private enterprise, can build stuff, you know, quickly. And there was a difference between building a mock-up for a set, but that kind of go-get-em type of attitude that some of these entrepreneurs have, like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson, I think that's going to be very helpful to getting us to Mars. I think in the short order, hopefully, as soon as they start getting more and more people into space. And it's going to be expensive, but their goal is to make it less expensive. I was in Seattle last night with a good friend of mine, Nick Patrick, who's a former astronaut who works for Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos. Mm-hmm. Jeff Bezos' company. And my friends are scattered for all these different companies. And they're not just trying to get people to space. They want to get it so it's cost-effective, too. They want people to be able to afford to go. And I think the more people have the chance to go, it's great. You know, you'll be able to see this beautiful planet. It's a great experience. And
I want to go.
Everybody want to go? Who wants to go to space? So I think that's good. And I think also for inspiring the young people who are involved or interested in STEM, I had the moon landing to inspire me as a little boy. What a lot of these students are interested in now. Is not just working for NASA, but also being entrepreneurial about it. And so they see the options of going to SpaceX or Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic or whatever that company, those private space companies might be. They see that very exciting. So I have students who go to the Jet Propulsion Lab, who go work at Kennedy Space Center, you know, JSC, NASA. But our valedictorian is very smart young lady. Our valedictorian 2 years ago, Nicole Lewis, is at Virgin Galactic. My TA, PhD in mechanical engineering, is at Blue Origin. John Kyle is up there, and a bunch of other students are over at SpaceX. So I think it's the way to go. I think it gives us another option of getting there. And I think there's only so much the government can do. And if they're successful, it could be extraordinary. It might be different than flying airplanes. I mean, it's going to be different than flying airplanes, of course.
But I mean, even the model for it, you know, is a little bit different. You know, with airplanes, you're actually going somewhere and you're visiting or transferring, you know, moving material. Maybe we'll get to that in space someday too. But I think at first, at least, the idea of tourism, the experience of it, and if they can be successful at it, it's going to open up this frontier to a whole new industry in a golden age of space flight, I think. So we need them to be successful.
Would you go back? Are you interested in going to Mars?
Mars. I want to come back from Mars.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's one-way trip stuff. I'd stay away from that. You know, I don't like that idea.
No.
No. When I got my travel orders, you know, because it was a government operation, we had travel orders. Everywhere you go with the government, you get travel orders.
Right? And this is like travel. An envelope. They
an envelope. They get, here's your travel order. No matter where you're going. Like, hey, I'm going to Cleveland next week. And so, you know, secretary comes over, here's your travel orders, right? And he says, with your name and your social security number and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, from Houston, Texas to Cleveland, and this is where you're going to stay in a hotel, government approved, and this is your government airfare ticket. Don't get anything out of the
mini bar.
The mini bar, none of that. All those rules are in there. The whole bit, you know, behave yourself. If you're arrested, don't call us. Whatever they're going to put on it, right? The whole bit is in there. So as I'm getting ready to go and leave for the Kennedy Space Center, my travel orders arrive. And it says, you know, my name, just everything the same way, my social security number, my blah, blah, blah. And then it says, from Kennedy Space Center, Florida, to low Earth orbit. Right? But here's the key, Adam. I was reading, and it says, end return. It was that end return that I was looking for. And I was like, all right, now I can breathe. The other stuff it had on there was interesting. It said, lodging, you know, because it would say lodging. Right. Lodging provided. Right. And then my meal allowance, meals provided. But I think there was a snafu in the administrative system. They could not zero out our incidental expenses. So I got paid like $3.23 a day for being in space extra. Incidental expense, they couldn't zero that out. I don't know why. I'm sure they tried. But they couldn't do it. So we got paid like $2 or $3 a day.
Is there a mini bar up there?
There is. It's called the pantry, but it doesn't have any alcohol in it. Yeah, we have pantry items. This is so you have your own food allowance, but you do have a pantry where you have extra M&Ms and macaroni and cheese and stuff like that.
Do you have trouble with people stealing each other's food?
Yes. Well, no, I shouldn't say. I never had trouble because I used to steal my friends' food. They weren't going to eat it. Why can't I tell? No, what we did is, no, we really didn't. No, I never stole anyone's food in space. But what would happen is sometimes you didn't, you know, you ordered what you thought you would like, but then maybe you didn't get enough of, let's say, lasagna. Say you really like that. But what they did with us is they had our food was all, you know, it was planned out. And what he did is everyone had a color, had a different color. The commander was red, the pilot was yellow, Mission Specialist 1 was blue, Mission Specialist 2 was green, blah, blah, all the way down. My first flight, for example, I was purple. And what they would do is they put little dots, purple, on all your stuff. You have a dot on all your things, your shoes, you know, on your locker,
right.
And on your food, they put a little dot on your food, so you knew what it was. But those dots were held on with it, you know, like a glue. You could peel those dots off. Not that anyone would ever do that. Like, not that someone would take, let's say, creamed asparagus and take the purple dot off and put that on the shrimp cocktail and take the red dot off and put it on mine. So I'm going to have some shrimp cocktail. Not that anyone would do it, but it was possible. It was possible. Not that anyone would ever do that.
I think if the problem got out of hand, they might start to just dye the food so then the blue lips you had would reveal.
Don't give them any ideas. Don't give them any ideas. Yeah.
Did you, that letter, those travel orders, did you save that? That seems like a perfect.
I sure did.
Yeah.
Yep. Still got them.
That's amazing.
Yep.
You were the first astronaut to tweet from space.
Yes. Yeah.
How important is social networking to the future of space travel?
I think it's really important. I think that one of the reasons why young people can be engaged with the space program is they're excited about it. I was excited because of the moon landing, we talked about that, and now, you know, we're not launching from the United States right now, we're launching from Russia, but I think the young people, one of the reasons they're excited, not just the private companies and things that NASA are doing, but because they can engage in social media. You can see what all astronauts now tweet and Instagram and whatever else we got going, they'll do it now,
And from our side of it, from my side of it, I just happened to, the timing worked out. I just happened to be the guy who was going into space next. My crew was coming up. We launched into space in May of 2009, and Twitter was starting to get popular right around that time. And they wanted someone to be send the first tweet from space. And timing-wise, it worked out for our crew, and they asked me to do it. And I was like, yeah, sure. What I really liked about it was a way to share the story. One of the reasons I like sitting here talking with you and sharing with all these nice people here today is I like sharing this extraordinary experience that I had. And the book is a way to do that as well, all these shenanigans, let's say, that I was able to include in the book. I get to share them that way. But Twitter was great. It was only 140 characters. Still is. And even I could do that. I tried doing a blog. That was a little bit too much. You know, I felt like I was back in high school trying to write a term paper or something. Yeah. And it would get people, my spelling was wrong, and the blog was getting a little bit too complicated with the short term I had trying to get ready to fly in space. But a 140 character sentence or picture or whatever, that was, I could do that, right? So that would give me time in between training sessions and in orbit. In between whatever we were doing, I would jot something down. So, but that was great because it was a way to share these experiences with lots of people, trying to be honest about what I was saying and what I was feeling and how wonderful it was to started in training about a month before we flew and then all the way up through the flight and then afterwards as well. So I think it's been great. You like the Twitter? I mean, everyone loves Twitter, right? Or likes it? No. And no one likes Twitter. Okay, so we'll stop. Adam won't do any of it. No, it's a great way, I think, especially for NASA to share what it's doing, its photos, and it's perfect for space travel, because you're able to do these extraordinary things and share them with people. And that's what my colleagues have been doing ever since.
One thing I know from talking to astronauts is that a spacewalk is an incredibly physically grueling experience. You're working against the pressure of the suit, and you're out there for hours and hours. Yeah. What I was wondering was looking at the famous picture of you on the Hubble mission smiling at the camera.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the time to take a photo has been worked into the mission so that they know when it's time. But is it hard to smile at that point? You're like, oh.
No. Well, it was... No, that photo, there's one, I think it's the one with the Hubble's in the background, and that was at the end of my last spacewalk. And those photos, the only time a photo is sort of kind of worked in is your very first spacewalk. You have a period of time of 15 minutes called translation adaptation. And the reason we have that is because you're training in the pool so often. And moving around in the pool is different than moving around in space for a number of reasons, but primarily because you have drag, viscosity of the water slows you down. And people, it slows you down. But that's a good thing because it makes you more stable. It's just enough to make you more stable. It's a little bit of drag in that situation is good. In space, there's nothing to slow you down. So if you were to approach your spacewalk, and we say walking, but you're not really using your feet, you're using your fingertips to move around. If you were to use those same gains, let's say, in the way you're moving around, you're going to go flying. You're going to make yourself into a momentary satellite, which isn't so good, And your safety tether will probably, would save you, right? You're going to get reeled back in. But I'm not sure what would be on the end of that line when they got me back, because I just the idea of flipping head over heels in space, I don't know if my heart would last.
Yeah.
You don't want to rely on that safety tether. You want to be careful. And so you want to move around very, very slowly in space.
So
and in
a
order
period
to do
of time
that,
for you to get
right. So this is your 15 minutes of translation adaptation. And one thing you want to do during that time is to go up to the window and make sure someone's there ready with the camera and take these hero shots of you. So that you get they call them hero shots because you try to look like a hero. So that was interesting because on my first flight I was pretty much scared out of my mind, right? We're like, oh my gosh, I'm in space, right? And I got to come up and smile like this, like, okay, I'm done now, let me go on to the, that kind of, so that was a little bit more difficult. At the end of that one I think you're talking about, when I have a big smile on, they actually put it on the cover of the Washington Post, which was pretty cool. I got that as soon as I landed, one of the NASA people handed it to me, so that's cool. But that one was taken at the end of my fourth spacewalk, and I was really exhausted, but that was also when we had a problem with this repair, when I stripped the bolt, and we were able to get around it, so I was extremely happy, and it was easy for me to smile. You are exhausted. I mean, I think that's what your point is, that you're exhausted beyond pretty much the end. My visor was down. I couldn't even realize that. Yeah. I told you in one of the earlier spacewalks toward the end, And I was so exhausted I couldn't even figure out, and just figured, well, I'm just going to muddle through this and not worry about it. And you're drained mentally and physically pretty much to the end of it. But at the end of that second spacewalk on my second flight, which ended up being the last spacewalk of my career, and I described this in the book as well, as I was, you know, getting ahead at the very end, trying to get ahead, always try to get ahead of what you're going to do. And my spacewalking buddy was still cleaning up back at the telescope, putting some stuff away. He was on the robot arm, and he was doing an inventory. And I was in the airlock getting stuff ready for our ingress, and then we were going to come inside at the end. And my commander, Scott Altman, comes over the comm, and he says, "Mass, what are you doing?" And I go, "I'm just, you know, cleaning stuff up." And he says, "Is there anything you're doing now that can't wait for later?" And I was like, "No, I can wait. What do you got?" And he goes, "Why don't you go outside and enjoy the view?" And I was, it's like, okay. You know, it's coming from my commander. And I just floated up, and that's when I went up and took that photo. And it was, I had this, was a real gift. And Scooter, Scott Altman, is one of my best friends. And I think he was looking out for me. You know, let's not let Mass miss this. And I had the sense that was probably my last spacewalk. And it is. I'm not going to be able to do that again. I hope to go to space again, but I'm not going to get a chance to spacewalk again. And getting a chance to do that on Hubble at that altitude was really special. And this was the last few moments. And my buddy was like, "Why don't you get outside and enjoy it?" And that's when I took that photo. And then I clipped my waist tether in to a handrail, and I just let go and watched the view. And it was this great feeling of just utter joy with that. And such a gift. I mean, I felt it was such a gift that I had been given to become an astronaut and to get to do these things. But those last minutes of watching the Earth go by was extraordinary. So it's, to answer your question that you asked about 20 minutes ago, it's not so hard to smile under those conditions, no matter how beat you are.
Yeah.
It's really okay. It's really easy to get a smile worked up there. Yeah.
I think that's a great place to stop. Please give Mike Massimino a huge hand.
Thank you.
It's been such an honor.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here with me.
Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
I really
appreciate it. Thank you, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was engineer and former NASA astronaut Mike Massimino, whose new book is Spaceman. He was joined in conversation by Adam Savage. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.